Let's start with this quote from Azrael of Gerona. If you're ever traveling in Europe and you're going to spend some time in Spain, it's worth going to Gerona, which is a beautiful little town where it was a Kabbalistic town. There's a beautiful Jewish quarter that you can see where some of the most famous rabbis of our entire history lived. And one of them was Azrael, and there were others too. It was part of the Spanish mysticism, and it's up north toward Barcelona. This is from Derech HaEmuna veDerech HaKfira. He says, you may be asked, how did God bring forth being from nothingness? It's the great question of religion, which is, why is there something instead of nothing? Do you believe in Genesis? Do you believe in the Bible? Do you believe that God had an influence? Do you believe in God, meaning that God did the universe instead of something else did the universe? And he says, because is there not an immense difference between being and nothingness? Nothingness is being, and being is nothingness. Okay, that sounds like a very Zen thing to say. The mode of being, but there's an answer. He's going to explain it. So he gives you the Yoda version, and then he gives you the answer, the explanation. The mode of being, as it begins to emerge from nothingness, is called emunah, faithfulness. For this term applies neither to visible, comprehensible being, nor to nothingness, invisible and incomprehensible, but rather to the nexus of nothingness and being. Our limited mind cannot grasp or fathom this because it connects to infinity. And this is his explanation of what we were talking about last time, which is the fact that infinity is the ultimate ground of, or the ultimate context or backdrop or condition of everything finite. But the fact that something finite comes from infinity is impossible for a mind to grasp. I mean, theoretical physics tries to understand it, but it gets up to against the border of what we don't, that can't be understood, or can only be understood in some ways mathematically, but it really is. I mean, how does something finite come from something infinite? It's the ultimate question, but they're in some ways incompatible. And this idea that somehow the first step of the way we understand it is the step of going from Ein Sof, God's sort of truest name, which means infinity in Hebrew, to the first step of manifesting as reality, as anything that we can think of or anything that's real, is actually also something you can't imagine, which is complete nothingness. But nothingness not in the sense of like empty space, but rather nothingness as the condition of not yet being. So it's often in Buddhism they have the same concept. The big revelation of the Buddha was something he called shunyata or anatman, and both of those ideas basically mean that, sometimes translated as no self or no thing, that everything to us, our mind works in such a way as to think of the world, our experience, ourselves as things. And as many philosophers have said since, whether it's Kant or many, many brilliant philosophers who never studied Buddhism or Judaism, came to the idea of how much of what we think is real is a product of the way the mind works, rather than the way the world actually is. This is like maybe one of the biggest philosophical questions ever. And the answer the Kabbalists give, which is kind of accurate, is or the Buddhism and others, is, well, it's kind of a combination. I mean, like, we're not saying, a lot of people, if you ask that question, they say, oh, are you saying that everything is a dream? And they go to the Taoist saying that, you know, am I having a dream of a butterfly, or is a butterfly having a dream of me dreaming of a butterfly? In other words, they think that what you're saying is there's nothing real. Everything is just a manifestation of a mind somehow. And the answer is no, you don't have to go in that direction. You don't have to go extremist with it. But there is a sense in which, you know, like, if just on a simple level, if our mind, if a dog can smell things I can't smell, then the dog is tapping into something real that I'm not tapping into because my mind and senses can't do it. I don't have the tools to do that. And similarly, maybe there is static or something thrown up by my tools that then I think is part of what it's studying, part of what it's perceiving, but it's a property of the tool itself. And of course, this becomes huge in quantum dynamics, and the famous statement that came out of quantum dynamics, which is the observer changes that which is observed first through the act of observing. But to go back to what Azrael is saying, that yes, the main thing that the mind does that you don't want to assume as part of reality is it constructs an image of the way things are. It constructs its philosophy, its worldview around things. And a thing seems like a static object, right? But it struggles, or it's not that it's completely blind. It misleads. It's not that it's impossible to perceive reality exactly like it is. It is impossible to perceive reality fully like it is, but it's not like you're completely screwed. It's just that you have to constantly give yourself cognitive therapy or spiritual therapy about the fact that which you perceive as static things are not actually static. They are part of flowing changes. So Krista is not the same Krista I met a few years ago, but I certainly treat her like she is a lot of the time. I'm like, oh, Krista, yeah, well, let's just pick up where we left off 5 years ago and in our conversation. And I certainly assume my wife is the same wife I left this morning, is the same wife when I get back. But the truth is, none of that's true. And it's not just that she is, and none of this is trivial. It's not just that, Rabbi or Azrael, you're exaggerating. The changes are minimal. I can track the changes between Lynn this morning and Lynn now. They're minimal. Don't make such a big deal of them. But you're still not on it yet, because it's not just that she has new experiences since this morning, but we're all part of so many ebbs and flows that are going on. So we're part of the whole Trump revolution, right? We're part of time. We're part of a zillion things going on. This is a personal note. One of my questions in my life is, am I ever going to have any good new ideas? Right? Like, am I ever going to come up with a great Yom Kippur sermon for next Yom Kippur? And there's a part of me that just feels like, I'm not going to. I've had all my good ideas. I've already shared my idea. You know what? Because I forget that it's not just about the fact that I'm changing, which I am, but that the world is changing around me. And it's going to stimulate my mind in new ways. Like, I really am. If I give the vegetarian sermon that I gave 9 years ago, then that would be a little bit fake, because I may have changed on vegetarianism, and the world may have changed on how it treats animals. And what people are hearing now is different than they heard 9 years ago. I mean, that's the cool thing when you give a sermon and everyone tells you you're crazy, and then 5 years later people are like trying to explain to you how, like, you shouldn't eat the meat because it's not ethically raised. And you're like, well, you were in my sermon where I talked about that. And they're like, what? What? You know, and so, like, even they didn't realize that they heard something that went in their head that they just ate it on. Or maybe they're like, no, I didn't really hear it. I was thinking about something else. But you could have been thinking about something else, but then part of your brain heard it. You know, like, in other words, we're not even aware of the things that are entering our brain, the things we're perceiving, the things we're taking in, and it affects all of our relationships. You know, I mean, my mother-in-law is visiting now. She basically visits once a year, and you kind of pick up where you left off before. But you're not the same. You know, I'm not the same. She's not the same. And, like, it doesn't have to be the same as it was before. Or it looks the same, but it's not really the same. Like, that's what all of this is trying to get to, which is that you're also part of these flows. You're part of time. You're part of a lot of influences on you. And that's what's invisible. So the real enlightenment of the burning bush and the real enlightenment of mysticism is a kind of ongoing... I was going to say fight, but that's my word. They don't use that word. I mean, what does that say about your relationship with yourself or with your mind? You have a curious relationship with your mind. Your perceiving organism. Your thing that is construing reality and helping you make decisions. Like, you have to make it your... You don't want to consider it you. But you also have to befriend it. You can't make it your enemy. Because so you have to have this kind of bemusing, playful, friendly relationship with your own mind. But also you can't think it's a thing, because nothing's a thing. But it's like this, it's not a mechanism, I don't know, a faculty, there are all kinds of words. You don't want to blow it up too much, because one of the problems is you can create a metaphysics of the mind, and then all you've done is created this machinery that you think you understand because it's a thing, and you're like, these are all just words. have a relationship with, like, your ego. Oh, that rabbi, what's the ego? Okay, I want to give you some ideas about the, oh, okay, now I have an ego. And I, happened with Freud, I have a conscience, I have a super ego, I have an ego, so now we have these. And as, like, Heschel pointed out, well, you know, where is it? I can't see it. Have you done scientific experiments to prove it? No. Like, so these are words to help us in our relationship with ourselves, but we don't want to make the words another idol that we accept as the system. I'm not really, I'm not into organized religion because I'm into psychology and I know how things work. It's like, oh, you're back to things, you know. But you have this kind of relationship. What religion is, in a lot of ways, Judaism, what they're saying is this ongoing corrective, ongoing therapy. You're always in therapy. You're never cured. And your ongoing therapy is to help you see Monty in the way he's changing, but also don't say, bad mind, bad mind. You don't think he's changed. You're still thinking of him as an object. Be like, no, 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 it's okay. You know, we think of him as an object. You think of your kids. Our mind is going to think of things. It's going to, all the world's is a stage, and everything's got these objects on it, and I'm the main character walking through it. And okay, you can do that. Like, I'm not going to hate you. I'm not going to, like, put a bullet through my head to try to end you. But we have an ongoing therapy to be awake to the way things are flowing in time. And then they kind of have this idea that if you could put on God glasses, you would see this room differently. You wouldn't see it as a collection of people. We're influencing each other as we sit. There could be auras and energies that are intermingling. Something that's getting said, a joke that's getting said, a story that's being told, could drift into your consciousness and be changing you. That you would see those. If you could see the patterns, you would see what's filling this empty space. And then they say, this nexedness of nothingness and being, that's the flow in time of the changes that are happening. So we see the picture frames, but we don't see the black in between, but if you ran it, it would be the movie. Which is, you see us moving, and you don't, and it just nadav, 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 but we don't see the black in between of the film, which would be God, which would be the nothingness. That's the nexus of nothingness and being. So, as the Buddha said, the essence of things is really that there is no thingness to them. There's no essence. That the thing is a picture that the mind takes. We take pictures. The brain is a picture-taking mechanism, and then the mind kind of moves the pictures around. But it doesn't see that the in-between is that people are involved in a flow of time and change and streams, and we don't realize all the streams that are affecting us. And that's what Moses kind of perceived of the burning bush. And our mind... And so let's go back to emunah, faithfulness. That's the basis of the word amen. And the amen comes from the same word we use means to believe. And it comes... emunah means faith. And any biblical scholar will tell you that it seems like its original meaning was something that's solid, something that is dependable. And so faithfulness is like, you know, if I have a relationship of faithfulness and it's in my wife, it means that I can count on her. I can depend on her. And if you come to Friday night services and we do the Shabbat Psalm and it says that you show love in the morning and faithfulness at night, I often will tell you that how enlightened I feel about that Psalm, that like, you wake up in the morning and you want to be ready to love everybody in it. But at night, it's about those people who can count on you. Right? The stranger on the street can't count on me, but I hope that I have the love to share with all strangers. But at night, it's not about the stranger. It's about those people that know I'm going to be there for them. It's about who's dependable, who's solid. It's a solid basis. It's a solid foundation. So now look what he says. Our solid foundation is flowing. Like, it's really intense, because what he's saying is that, yes, the thing that we say amen to, it's solid, it's dependable, it's God, right? It's the Torah. All of the things we say, you can depend on that. It's amen. It's the God that reality relies on. It is the Big Bang depended on this thing. And then he's saying, it's not a thing. The thing that is most solid is this flow. So, you know, and then you're like, I mean, and then Yoda comes back in, right? You know, yes, the one thing you can depend on is change, or something like that. And yeah, like, it's very, very intense. And then you start, and then it's like, okay, now why is the word for solid the word for faith? Because it's like, you've got to, in a way, it's about connecting and giving yourself up to that flow. The one thing you're affirming is that flow. So one of the reasons I'm not crazy about orthodoxy is I do think they try to freeze. I mean, look, they do. They take a picture of Russia in 1850. And they're like, let's dress like that. What, you have something against the rabbi? You have something against your rabbi fathers of 1850? I'm like, no, I don't have anything against my rabbi fathers of 1850. I don't have anything against my Spanish rabbi fathers of 800. And I don't have anything against, you know, the Israelites of 200. You know, like you took a picture, and you're like, got to be faithful to that picture. And I'm like, you got to be faithful to the flow of Torah. Oh, I bet you want to marry gay people and stuff like that. And I'm like, yeah, I do. I mean, in other words, like, all you see is that I can't have faith because all I want to do is change with the times. Right? And I'm like, you don't understand me at all.
So,
yeah, I mean, in other words, I don't want to change. The fact that you're depending on the flow is that, first of all, you got to be connected to the flow. Right? I can't be like, hey, Naomi, you're changing before my eyes. So, now I assume this. That may not be true. Right? Just so it's like the rabbi's like, oh, you'll just go with the flow. So if they say this, I'm like, no, I have to actually be in touch with it. I have to be correctly perceiving it. I have to be receptive to it. I have to think about it. I mean, they're not turning off their brains. They're putting their brains on hyperdrive. You know, like, so, but if I'm like, yes, what I'm telling you is that we can have a debate. And if you're telling me that the flow of Torah in this world, the flow of Judaism, what it's meant to put our fingers on the pulse of, is that gay people need to be celibate or marry and against their sexual inclinations and then produce an unloving marriage where the person who loves them is never really loved back. Like, yes, I think the flow is that that's definitely against the flow, right? But it doesn't mean I'm like, and let's eat shrimp because, yay, you know, shrimp is just some ancient taboo. I'm like, oh, I'm not there. So, like, don't make assumptions just because I'm like, they're like, you can't put your finger on the flow, right? You got to take a picture. And it's the picture. And then I know if you're doing it right because I can compare it to the picture, right? You're not doing kosher right, like one of my teenagers told me here, right? Because you don't have two ovens, right? And I'm like, what picture are you comparing it to? The picture teacher told me at the academy. And I'm like, the guys who wrote the legal codes on kashrut didn't have two ovens. And they're like, I don't even know how to understand that, Rabbi. I just know you're doing it wrong, according to my picture. There we go.
Well, so, and actually getting toward the point that I was going to bring up.
Cool.
When, you know, looking at the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, chickens didn't lactate when the law was written. And then somewhere along the way...
Dude, you totally lost me. Chickens didn't lactate. Oh, no, okay, go ahead. Okay, I just need, I got to go back to that picture. Okay.
According to the laws now, chickens do lactate because I can't put a piece of cheese on my chicken.
Oh, God. Okay. I thought you were telling me that scientifically chickens lactate, and that was freaking me out.
There's a period of time in the middle where, according to Judaism, scientifically chickens do lactate. Because, well, it's I mean, the
not in the Torah. In the Torah, chickens don't lactate.
Exactly. Like, and that's what I'm saying. For the spirit and the letter of the law. The letter of the law, chickens don't lactate. It's don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Chickens don't. You know,
right.
They've never produced.
You're allowed to boil a chicken in its mother's milk because there is no mother's milk. No, that's what you say.
Some other mother's milk.
Some other, right.
Exactly. So, you know, and to me, part of the spirit of that is the whole have respect for the animal that gave its life to feed you by not cooking it in the thing that gave it its life.
Totally. I think that's totally what the flow is about.
So,
there. You don't... Scientific evidence is always, as you're pointing out, it's always allowed in halachic discussions, always has been. And that's very important to my spirituality and why I love Judaism. At the same time, is you don't want to be overly reductive. In other words, there may be other reasons for why we want to maintain that you can't eat dairy with chicken, even if, well, it's not in the Torah, right? It's a rabbinic prohibition, and there may be reasons for it that, like, in other words, that it's partly why, like, when you're making, well, you know, what is the image of the rabbi? Can I go to that for a second? Which is just this, which you can, like, when you're studying, like, what does it mean to be a decisor about the law? How do you make decisions about the law? The story that some of us go back to over and over again is the famous story, we don't know where it comes from. I don't know if it's Hasidic or Talmudic. It's one of the stories. It's just one of the stories of Judaism. Maybe it's apocryphal. Is the woman comes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, is this chicken kosher? right? And the rabbi says, bring it to me. And this is like what people like the Lubavitcher Rebbe and others did for a living. This is what rabbis did. They didn't lead services. Services happened without them, where they'd sit in the back. They did stuff like this. And so the woman brings the chicken in. And if it has a broken leg or it's blemished, it wouldn't be kosher if it's diseased in some way. And this chicken is looking mighty sorry, right? This is a mighty sorry looking chicken. It might have to be sold to the goyim. That's just the fact of the matter. And she obviously picked up. And so he's like, let me examine the chicken because I have to know whether this is just a spot or it's a freckle or it's a bad spot and all that kind of stuff. And while I'm examining, tell me, while you're here, I haven't seen you in a while. How's it going? How's your husband? How's your family? Blah, blah, blah. And so as, he's examining it, husband's still out of work, daughter's still sick, we don't know how we're going to pay the rent. And he's like, let me give you a little something from the tzedakah box. Oh, by the way, the chicken's fine, but I'm really more concerned about your daughter. Gives chicken back. Next person comes in with the chicken. The rabbi's examining, how's it going? Things are going well. I mean, the shop is kind of doing better than it was doing last year. We had a decent, we branched out to lemon trees, and the lemons are doing pretty well. But thank God, Rabbi, I don't have a lot to complain about. And he says, well, the only thing you can complain about is this is too sorry a looking chicken. You got to give this away. Like, this chicken definitely is not looking good enough for Shabbos. And I'm sorry to give you the bad news. And, that's what I was worried about. And the chickens are the same chicken. I mean, they look exactly the same. And so the idea being that what you want is someone who is aware of all of the factors that go into a situation. And it's not just a simple story about compassion, because it's also a story about reality. I think it's a crazy idea, to me anyway, but it's true. Halacha has this idea that once the rabbi rules, it makes it true. Right? Because you go by the rabbin... Go ahead.
Yeah, because we talked about this a few months ago. You were talking about a similar thing, and that's the whole question on the ghost cow.
Yes. That's the famous case, which is if the rabbi slaughters the animal and pronounces it dead and kosher and all this, and the animal gets up and starts walking around, that technically you're experiencing a ghost count. Because that animal is dead. It has been halakhically pronounced dead. It's like the priest in the temple where if Naomi came to me and she's like, Rabbi, I had the skin blemishes, blah, 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 and I'm the Kohen, and I'm like, you are now pure again. Well, I guess you don't make the cross. You're now pure again. You may enter. If the blemish starts going, she's clean. When you're pronounced clean, you are now clean, right? It can't be like the Kohen got it wrong. It could be that you go back, now you're not clean again, you have to leave the encampment. But it goes way back to the idea that a pronouncement actually creates, it can split reality between legal reality and true reality, but you live in legal reality. So how does putting a string around Poway make an Eruv and turn it into a shared courtyard, which is about an Eruv, right? And the idea is that as much as I can't stand the whole Eruv thing, I respect it halakhically, which is that you're allowed to count on Shabbat. I'm sorry, you're allowed to carry within... so here, Judy, I'll explain it really quickly. I'll explain it really quickly. On Shabbat, you're not allowed to carry unless it's on private property. Right, I'm allowed to carry a chair from one room to another in my home, but carrying is forbidden on Shabbat. Essentially, the rule about carrying is you can't carry from one property onto another, or from one property into public property like a street. Right? So I wouldn't be able to carry something to synagogue because I leave one property, I go to the street, and then I'm crossing into two different properties. So you can't carry across the border of a property. You can carry within a property. So there's a legal fiction. Where basically, it goes back to the ancient idea that, well, could you carry in a walled town? And it turned out that halakhically, you could carry within the old city of Jerusalem. Just consider, it's all one domain. We have a wall around the old city. You can carry your chicken, you can carry the flowers from one home to another on Shabbos. You're right within the little walled city. It's one private neighborhood. So then we created a legal fiction, which is if you wrap a string around any area, you can call it a walled city and therefore a shared private neighborhood. And people do it. The Orthodox are obsessed with it. Obsessed. I mean, obsessed. So that half of what it seems like the Orthodox community devotes it to, and I'm sorry if there's an Orthodox person listening, if I turn any of this into a podcast and I chop it into pieces, that they're like all their time spend burying strings around cities and things so that they can say that they can carry on Shabbos. But I actually do respect it halakhically. They're like, it's the ghost cow. You may say, that's just a string. But this is the way the legal system works, is they just made, the string is a wall, they made a walled town. A walled, by the transitive property, a walled town is a private, shared, HOA, communal space. And now they can carry their umbrella. Often you don't change the law. Like, your instinct might be, well, the guy just slaughtered that cow and it got back up. And that may be an apocryphal story. So let's just say, wait a second. Why don't we just make a law? Let's go to the chicken. Can't we just make a law that, like, if a poor person has a chicken, we use a more lenient standard of judging its kashrut than we do a rich person who has a chicken? Like, why don't we just change the law to build in what the rabbi is trying to do? And there's an enormous amount of wisdom about not doing that, because it is a fool's quest. If you're trying to parent, or you're trying to grandparent, or you're, you know, let's just put in parenting there. If you think that, oh, I just figured out this thing about how to deal with Amram, right? Now I get it. I'll just change my rule about how I deal with that son. Oh, and then it shifted again. Right? And another, right? Then you realize that if you keep trying to change the law, I'm not saying you're saying this then, I just want to point it out, that if the idea is a little bit reform or reconstructionist, which is the law doesn't speak to you, change the law. No one said you can't change the law, right? And I'm like, no, it's a fool's quest. Because you end up changing the law for the situation that you see, and then the flow goes on. So, for example, today's synagogues, I think, really need more Torah study, right? Because I don't think the choir is the most important thing. So if I say, let's redefine synagogues, they need Torah study. What if in 50 years, it's the music that brings people in, right? A lot of people think it's the music that brings people in now, and I think that's a real mistake for synagogues to build synagogues around, you know, which latest Friday Night Live band they're going to hire. I mean, I think that by the time you get around to figuring out how something works, it's usually already over. Like, you've missed the trend, you know what I mean? And you're like, oh, it's all about Havaraz. Wait, no one wants to be in Havaraz anymore. But we're going to do Havaraz, because that's what it worked 10 years ago. So, like, one thing I want to say is, the beautiful thing about Judaism is you don't change the law. I mean, for the most part. So you do occasionally. But you try to be, you have what's called Agadah. You have the, what it's like to live with the wall, with the law. What it's like to live with the law. And that shifts. That shifts. So, like, and that's called, like, our Agadah, our living relationship with the law. And the interesting thing about the Talmud is it says that your relationship with God lives in the Agadah, in the stories. The stories of how you live with the rules and how you live with the law. But don't change the law to accommodate you. But God's not in the law. God's in the way you live the law. And so I'm going to shift to one thing, and then I'm going to come back to what you said about how do you make a theory of law and changing the law. But I'm going to use, you've been wondering, why is it? It's just a picture of nothingness. So here you go. It's the white light. And you make, so one of the things that you're kind of saying is that, okay, so this is my attempt to, a little bit like the picture, but this is something that's, it's a little different than the picture. And this is my attempt to draw something like a funnel. So I'm going to take something from cognitive psychology, which is called the perceptual funnel. And it's something you all know, if you haven't heard of it, called the perceptual funnel, you may think of it another way, which is that we can only, our human minds only, we know from cognitive psychology experiments, they can only attend to a few things at once. All right? So that you're following my sentence, you're maybe thinking about something else, and you're not hearing Gina speak on the phone, right? But if Gina says fuck, you're like, what? And then, so we know, because I mean, these are easily replicable, I did cognitive psych at college, these are easy replicable experiments. So then you're like, so we are hearing what Gina's saying, right? So what we realize is there's tons of information. Information's even not the right word. Whenever you talk about this kind of stuff, you got to be careful just not to put too much stock in the words, right? Oh, now I get it. It's about information, because information's a loaded term. Is it sensory? This is why I got out of philosophy. Is it sensory data? stop putting labels on it. You're trying to invent a theory of how all of this is working, but every word you come up with will be laden with some picture of how it's some apparatus, some scientific. Let's just say there's a lot more going on than we're picking up. That's just like leave it be. But we're kind of picking it up. But what the mind does is it filters it. So only that and that gets through. And then sometimes it's only one thing gets through, or you could do more. But the bottom line is that at the bottom, there are only like a couple of things that you're really paying attention to. And so what Kabbalah kind of is that if it means receptivity, and what mysticism is, or spirituality is in general, you don't need a Kabbalah to have this idea, then how does it? Is there any benefit to trying to have moments where you open up to try to get more of the simultaneous? To try to open your perceptual funnel up through yoga, meditation, prayer, or just enlightenment, wisdom. How do we do that? I think that, I mean, one idea of coming out of Kabbalah is, like, this is a good thing. Like, to have moments where you try to realize that, you try to figure out, like, I actually can kind of hear Gina's conversation. And I kind of am hearing, well, they're not out there now, but, like, the kids on the playground. And I kind of am hearing on some level, maybe I'm going too far with this, like what's going on with Trump and what's going on with the country. And there's all kinds of things that are filtering in through my email, through my phone, and in this room. And you start to realize that's the flow. So we are in the flow. And it's partly our minds that we want to focus on a couple of things at a time, right? And we do it, whether it's with our kids. The main thing Rob's working on is how to read. She's six. There are so many things she's working on that I don't even have a clue about, right? Can I see them? Instead of being like, no, she's working on her letters, right? Ziva's working on her letters. My God. You know, as you probably know, a three-year-old, they learn a new word every 3 hours, if you bother to teach them. It's one of the problems that we've learned in parenting, which is that people talk baby talk to kids, and they don't understand why their test scores are bad 10 years later. You know, like, really. I mean, you take a kid from the inner city, and you talk to them in normal words, I use words like perceptual and stuff like that. But if you miss that age where they're actually, their brain, I don't even know what she's going through. She's growing in so many zillions of ways, but I'm going to attend to just the triangle and the square. I can only focus on a couple. I can only track a couple. We're only tracking a few things at a time, right? You're only going to track a few things in this. Rav Nadav's throwing all this stuff at you. You're lucky if you track one thing that you can take away. I know that. That's fine. You know, that's the way the mind works. So how do we take it in? This is called being receptive. This is called receiving. This is called receiving through there, where it's flowing downward in a way. But it's not just downward. It's there's a flow. But can you kind of open up? The more you're aware of all of the influences that are affecting your brain, that's a little bit of therapy. A little therapy for, like, who am I? What's going on with me? There's all this stuff. It's my mother. It's my age. It's the last report from my doctor. It's what I got on the news. It's the weather. You know, it's the traffic. It's the money. It's all of it. Like, but you got to let go of I'm just one thing. Like, I'm all of these flows. Well, Rabbi, are you saying there's no center? Is there no soul? No, there's a center of gravity. Let's call it a center of gravity. You know, it's like whatever. It's like, you know, you look at the sun, it looks like one thing. It's actually just a bunch of gas. You know, like, the soul is like, there is a, I'm not saying there's, there's no Nari. There's like this nexus little energy point. And all this stuff is flowing through her. But think of it like that, like the center of a hurricane or something like that, right? And that's why the Buddha is saying, but there's no self. Like, that's the first of the teachings of the Buddha. It's not a thing in there, right? It's a combination of things, of influences, and some of them are, like, Or are you saying there's no DNA? Some of it's DNA. It's predisposition. Some of it's how you're raised. Some of it's experiences that you had when you were a child you no longer remember. I mean, why go through therapy to remember your childhood? It's not to, oh, now I got it. Mommy said this, and I'm a triangle. No, it's supposed to be like, there's my mommy, there's that stuff that, it, you know, there, so there's all kinds of stuff. It's all of it. And so the more you realize we're so complex, I mean, there's not one lesson from this, except for the fact that the rabbi and the chicken. You can't make a rules about a flow. But what you can say is, look, we have to have some rules, which is, you know, like in my house, you know, I don't know, you don't eat your vegetables, can't have dessert. Like, you don't change that rule because Rob doesn't like her vegetables, right? Maybe we work within the rules. Well, we'll find a different vegetable if you don't like that one. Or, you know, or, okay, on Shabbat, you can have dessert without eating your vegetables because it's Shabbos. I mean, you can modify things around, but you don't give up on the rules. The rules are, in a way, the general principles about how things work. And you can't just keep changing them because you found an exception. But in your application of them, the more that you are receptive in the moment to what is in front of you, the more you know how to apply the rules and the more you know how to live. So that you don't change the rules about chickens. The moral of the story is not to say poor people have lower standards of chicken evaluation. It is the fact that, or because you know what? A poor person could come into the next rabbi with a chicken with spots. And because the rabbi, if they're enlightened, if they're a good rabbi, they may realize that for this person, that chicken's not kosher. Because have you ever noticed, I'm just throwing this out there, the obvious stuff. Sometimes the best thing you can do for someone who's down on their luck is to treat them like a real person without special circumstances. You know, I was younger, I was working in San Francisco. I remember it was late at night, like in the Tenderloin, and I handed a 20 to, to a bum, I don't know, with a homeless person. Back then we had different words. And he said, it's too much. And I said, it's not too much. Come on, man. I can afford a 20. And he was like, it could be. But he was like, I don't need 20. He's like, I want a donut and a cup of coffee. Right? And so, and he was like, I just want to go into that place over there, you know, the corner, whatever, deli thing. And he's like, I want 5. So I was like, I'll give him 5. Right? And he, of course, you all know, you've all had experiences like this. He's teaching me that, like, you maybe demeaned me a little bit by giving me too much. So I can't make the rule. You know, oh no, you, it's, so, you know, Alex brings me his chicken and it looks really sorry. And I'm like, it's fine, Alex. It's kosher. And Alex is like, the rabbi totally just treated me like I'm a needy bum. Right? So we can't make a rule. So how, it's all about being receptive. And receptivity is the God glasses. When Alex comes, sorry, Alex, I'm picking on you. When Alex comes in to me with his, lousy looking chicken, I got to know, like, what is the flow in front of me? Is it a flow of someone who needs a little bit of what's called, it would be this one. It would be Gevurah. Gevurah is, I need to channel red energy into here. The red energy is, I'm going to treat you like I treat anybody else and not like the poor person who's desperate for this chicken, right? And that what that person needed is Gevurah, right? When Ziva's crying because yesterday, I wanted Lynn to have time with her mom, and Ziva didn't want to let, she's very attached to Lynn, she didn't want to let Lynn go out to dinner with her mom, and she really threw a fit. And I made a difficult decision because it's very hard to say no to her. And in general, I err on the compassionate side. I try to make things work. In general, I'm like, we can make this work. But in that case, I was like, I need to tell her you can be away from mom. And I had to be Gevurah. I had to be like, no, the hammer's coming down of the law. And mommy's going out with grandma, and we're going to go to soup plantation. And it all worked out great. But I don't usually go, but it's the same thing as the chicken's not kosher, and I don't care how bad the business is going. And then, or is what is in this situation that I'm feeling, I'm like, in this situation, that chicken's kosher. So there's no way to make rules from it, and life is about receptivity and nourishment.
But is that just, it's still just my perception. It's not necessarily what's truly real.
I mean, I mean, one of the ways I take that, but it's not exactly what you said, but is that, you know, sometimes if I'm giving a lecture on this stuff, right, like, let's say, tapestry or something like that, and a bunch of people come up to me and they're like, Rabbi, I'm so, you know, I'm so down with this stuff, I'm Kabbalistic, or I'm a yoga teacher, or I do meditation, or I'm an acupuncturist, and I get it with the chakras and the energies, right? The fact that you're into it doesn't mean anything to me. Because you could be just as deluded as the next person.
Exactly.
That makes sense, right? The person who comes up to the Buddha who's like, dude, I'm your next bodhisattva. I've been listening to teachings, take them there. That doesn't mean anything to me. Because and I can be deluded, right?
There could be danger in that, right?
Right, there's danger in it. I've always been resistant to the kind of guru types. I just shy away from them. Like, oh, Rabbi, you got to come to the nature center for the retreat. You'd be so into it. And I'm like, actually, it's one of my last places I want to be. I can, in my opinion, I can dive in this stuff better here than I can going out in the woods with someone who's like, and now we're all feeling the chakras of the wheat growing in the field. But I can pray feeling the chakras of the wheat growing in the field right here with Marty or Jack or Rafi up on the Bima doing it in Hebrew, and I'm just dabbing it to myself. Like, so, you know, one thing I don't want to say is that you're right, which is that you don't know if you're really being receptive or not. Yeah. And all this is saying is, well, I mean, there's some checks and balances, but they're all crapshoots. Which is, one is, go seek for yourself a Rav, right? It's one of the main points of the Mishnah. Never trust a guru who doesn't have a guru. Never trust a rabbi who doesn't have a rabbi. Like, in other words, you better always be fallible. And if you're really, I mean, the problem is if you have a guru, you know, if it's Scientology, it's not really going to help that your guru's got a guru, because it's all just a big sham. But, you know, like, it's about humility. I mean, it's about, to the best you can, cultivate humility that you can be wrong. So on the one hand, can you have someone who is your corrector, which is like, I don't know, like I did a vision presentation for the synagogue of where I would, and I gave it about 8 months ago to the board, and it was like where I'd like to see us go and the kind of help I want, and not that much happened from it so far, but a little bit. But one thing is I sent it to my rabbi in L.A., and I thought he was going to be like, this is the most brilliant thing I've ever seen. This is like the crystallization of my ideas about what synagogues are and where they need to be going. And he was like, I really don't like what... I mean, in general, he's like, it's really good, but I really hated like page two. You know, I was like, that's my favorite page, you know? You got to have the thing, which is like, he's like, your finger's not on... I mean, one thing I said is, I said, you know, like, I really feel board members really need to step up and like come to services and do things and blah, blah, blah. And I just felt like that was so important, you know, that the board does leadership. And he was like, no, the board's doing a lot already. Like, and he doesn't even know the synagogue. He's like, why are you slamming the board with Gavura? You know, and I'm like, because they need a kick in the pants. He's like, I don't think so. I think it's your ego. I think it's your frustration, right? You want someone at services, pick on the board. So like, in other words, I'm like, and he doesn't even know. But it's like, you have someone you go to, a friend, you know, someone, but they better be worthy. But that's why it's like a Rav, or, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, someone who can be a Rav to you, whether they're officially a rabbi or not. And then the other thing is, life will kick you in the friggin' pants. So, I mean, like, you know, there is something called reality. So it's like, oh, I totally know how I'm going to deal with this child. I'm going to, you know, I have a child who, let's say, tells tall tales, right? And, you know, I totally know. And then, you know what? You do all this stuff, you got it all solved, and then three more juicy tall tales come out. And you're like, okay, I totally suck. I mean, I cannot figure this, you know. But so life also can have a way of just, you know, I don't know, you think you give the most brilliant Yom Kippur sermon, and people are like, well, left me cold. But we still like you, Rabbi. You know, I guess I thought I had my finger on the pulse, you know, and I didn't. There are times I just really, you know, feel I do, and yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, and sometimes you just have to let it go and move on, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of it is like, well, it's a new flow. I can sit here and beat myself up about the fact that, you know, no one except Jen Klotzkin liked my sugar sermon, which I thought was completely brilliant and important, and my finger on the pulse. And I don't understand how I give this, like, big sugar sermon about 5 years ago, and then people are like, you gave a sermon about sugar, like, what the hell did you do? Like, what did you friggin' waste High Holy Days on a sermon about sugar? And I'm like, and then it's like 5 years later, it just came out, this big conspiracy that the sugar industry has paid to produce research saying how great sugar is when it's completely bad for you and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I was so there 5 years ago. You guys remember my sugar sermon? And people were like, no, we don't remember it. Or yes, we remember it and it sucked. So like, I'm like, no. And they're like, dude, you are still living in the sugar sermon. Like, move on. You know, like, so in other words, it's like, so part of it's life kicks in the pants, part of it, you just got to move on. And part of it's like, because I wasn't receptive yesterday, maybe I can be receptive today. So we do make mistakes, but you know, it's about getting used to reading reality. So one of my favorite things about Judaism is it's a spirituality of reading, right? Why are we doing this? I know you're like, oh my God, we're still on Ehi Asher Ehi, but it is the very nature of God. And we're not going to get any of that anymore. We're not going to get another verse in Torah that talks about the nature of God. Like, really. So, like, I mean, well, you know, let's, so we're going to linger on it. But so Judaism is about reading and a spirituality of reading. And as I've said many times, it's because it's trying to teach you to read reality as well. And so the idea, I mean, and I know you guys appreciate this, but, like, it's so mind-blowing and revolutionary and different than reading in other religions. You read to get the truth. You read to find out what Jesus is telling you to do. You read to find out what they say reality is. And the idea that next year I can say, forget everything I did last year. I'm totally like that whole flow thing, not going to get you anywhere. Forget it. It's not getting me anywhere. It's just leading you to this terrible place. We're going to read this completely differently. You know, the fact that you can do that, oh, so you had it wrong before. No. I'm moving on from the sugar sermon. I'm moving on from the flow sermon. Forget the funnel. Not work. It's not, I'm at a whole nother place with it. And maybe it's because of Trump. And maybe it's because of where I'm at with my kids. And maybe it's because of these other influences. Maybe it's because of the economy. Maybe it's because of what's going on in California. Maybe it's because of global warming. Or maybe it's because of just my dad died. God forbid. You know what I mean? And I'm working through that. Forget the whole flow stuff. It means nothing to me anymore. Hold to it. But if you can learn to read in the moment and let it come alive and look at the details, it's teaching you to be the rabbi who knows which chicken is kosher and which isn't. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's teaching you to read people. It's teaching you to read your families. It's teaching you to read your kids and just move on, you know, and be like, well, what works now? And what's working? Who are they? We're all caught up in the same crazy thing. Because you're not going to just make a whole new set of laws about it. Remember that the Buddha said, he called his religion, I love it, his religion was not called Buddhism. What did he call it in English? It's the, and then it's two words. One starts with M and the next one starts with W. He said, I'm teaching, it's not anti-Hinduism. He's called it the middle way. That's what he called it. He said, I'm teaching the middle way. The middle way between, and then he is up.
Think what?
Between, for example, let's say with Nuri, between the fact that she has a soul and she doesn't have a soul. Between that she's a solid, understandable thing and she's in flux.
Duality.
It's duality, but one of the things he didn't like about duality, right, but go ahead.
It's in the middle.
It's in the middle, which is that it's that nexus in between. It's both, right? It's both, but also in any one moment you have to be receptive to what it needs to be right then. So, And then he's like, between the fact that, the classic example would be, what are relationships for the Buddha? So the Buddha says, how can you have a real relationship when you're changing and they're changing? Yeah. Right? And so what he basically says is that how can you make promises about what you're going to feel or think or be 10 or 20 years from now? And you don't know who you are 10 or 20 years now. You don't know what the flow did to you. And I think the Buddha's like, you don't. You really don't. And so the middle way is something like, if right now it is right for Lynn and me to be in each other's lives, then I honor that. And when it's not, we move on. And I can't live a marriage that way. I'm not actually going to live the middle way. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm not a... later Buddhists changed all that because they had to make a religion from it. You can't really have a religion where you can't do weddings, right? You know, trust me. I mean, like, you gotta do a wedding. So I'm not saying later Buddhism didn't evolve this, but in that classical Buddhism, it's like the middle way is we want to be together now, we're together now. And we honor each other who we are right now. And then the second you change or I change, you know, move on. You know, if you love something, let it go. And the Buddha was very much about letting things go. Just let it go. You know, it's the kind of thing where, I don't know, you could be like, I don't eat pork. And then one day you're eating pork. Let it go. You know, like, and then the next day you don't. Like, stop it with trying to say who I am and what I need to be. But, so it's this middle way between thingness and nothingness and living in this world without being attached to it. I mean, so the bottom line was, he said it about attachment. It's the middle way between being attached and not attached. He leaned toward not attached. Even in a relationship, you can be attached, but don't be attached. Like the second that the attachment isn't authentic, you just split up. You know, it could be that kind of thing where if someone's like, so trying to get being attached to the fact that you have pictures of the way things are, and it's got to be the picture, and it's got to be the picture, and it's got to be the picture. So that and I think conservative Judaism is the middle way. I think the Orthodox take pictures and say, I'm going to judge you by how much you're fitting the picture, and we're going to call a tradition and sing the song from Fiddler of the Roof, and we're all going to feel good. And, and if you're not feeling it, then something's wrong with you. I mean, we're all dancing the hora. I hate the hora. Don't make me dance the hora. Oh, no, you, Rabbi, you're not feeling the flow. The flow is the hora. I don't know. I don't think Rabbi Akiva knew the hora. So why do I need to? You know, boy, you're a weird one, Rabbi Cain. You know, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a weird one. I actually care about what Rabbi Akiva felt. You know, like, I mean, he's only the hero of the Talmud. So, like, it's like, I don't want to take a picture and say I have to feel it. But I'm in the middle way, because I also want to go the other way, which is whatever I happen to feel is Judaism. That doesn't help me grow, right? The laws basically say the same. And, you know, the whole thing, Kashrut's about what, you know, about motherhood and mother's milk. And they're like, you are crazy. Because according to traditional Orthodox Judaism, milk and meat are simply about showing your obedience to God. It's a chok. There's no reason for it. To give a reason for it is an act of not having proper faith in the fact that you do it because God said so. And that you're, and I'm like, I'm not into those pictures. So like, Stan asked, do you ever change the law? The thing I find funny is only this, and you may have heard me say this before, which is we conservative Jews are accused of changing the law willy-nilly all the time. I wish we would do it more. Like, the crazy thing is, we almost never do it. Okay, you say homosexuality is okay. Yeah, it took us 30 or 40 years to do that, right? It should have taken us 10. Like, that's, like, okay, we say it's okay. I'll do a gay marriage. I'll write a gay ketubah, right? Oh, by the way, the ketubah, right? The ketubah we all use, the Orthodox ketubah, that's like one ketubah from like the medieval period. They used to write a different ketubah for everyone. You're not going to use the ketubah? The picture of the ketubah. That's a ketubah. You know, the picture of Rambam Maimonides that we all know, if you know, because he's like the most important medieval philosopher. He's brilliant. That's not a picture of Maimonides. They didn't have a picture of Maimonides. They took a picture of someone else. And they used it for Maimonides. That's Maimonides! That's the picture! No, it wasn't. It was some kind of, like, Egyptian traitor. And, so the picture is, you got to go by the picture. But, like, we don't change that much. I'll write a special ketubah for gay people, and I'll marry them. I mean, like, what else have we done? I'm trying to think. Like, oh, women. Right, okay, you know my stuff on women. I'm like, okay, women can be rabbis. So women weren't rabbis. So,
But weren't they leaders or people who had influence 2,000 years ago before there were rabbinical Judaism?
Exactly. I mean, or even before medieval Judaism. I mean, yeah. The real restrictions on women come from the medieval period, right? The Dark Ages. Great. Thank you for taking your picture of the way we treat women from the Dark Ages. And even in the Dark Ages of Judaism, as you were saying, women were business owners. So one of the famous things we have is, and it was a frustration for the Dark Ages, the Catholic Church and the Muslim leaders, that women would show up to be running Jewish companies to make business deals. And they didn't know what to do because women weren't supposed to have the legal authority to make those deals. And they're like, even in those countries, technically the man owned the property, but the women were running the business. So right, I would say that really, it's that big a deal. It's going to put your panties in a bunch that much. I mean, I wish we would change the halakha more often, right? The rabbi drives an electric car on Shabbos and says that's kosher. And I'm like, yeah, I do. Really? I should do more things like that. You know, like, it's so rare we change anything. And I mean, so, like, the thing is that, for the most part, anyone who tells you, no, do conservative Jews keep halakha? No, they're terrible at it. If Orthodox Jew want to say, rabbi, I concede it all. You rarely change anything, and certainly it is in keeping with the changes that occurred historically, because judicial law did change over time. There were many new decisions and many radical changes, many of them for the worse and many of them for the better. So it's like, okay, if you show me scientifically you don't change things at any faster pace than were changed historically, I buy it. But the bottom line is, apparently changing things doesn't make people want to keep them, because conservative Jews don't keep a lot of the laws. So, okay, well, that's a sociological argument. That's an argument about tactics, right? You're telling me that I can't change the law to keep it in a way it's always been done because it's a bad tactic for getting people to keep it. But now, you know, like, now we're talking a different conversation. I'm happy to talk tactics. And I'm happy to say that conservative movement has come up with some really lousy tactics. I mean, like, fine, you know. And I'm happy to talk about, you know, some people say, well, the thing I like about Chabad is, you know, they have a really good system, but they're very effective at a lot of things they do. But now we're talking tactics. Do you know that the reason conservative Judaism opposed participation by non-Jews in the service officially in the decisions that came out of JTS in the 70s? I've read them all. Our official halakhic position was we oppose, like, non-Jews having honors. If you have a child who's getting married to a non-Jew, you're not allowed to host an oneg. You're not allowed to put their name in the news bulletin. This was official Jewish law. It was all based on the fact that it's a bad tactic. Because if you do that, it will encourage intermarriage. Right? Now, I think that's idiotic. So that if, you know, let's just say we have someone named Shlomo. Everybody loves Shlomo here, and Shlomo's daughter is going to be married to a non-Jew. If we celebrated it, maybe they'd want to maybe raise their kids Jewish if we embraced them, if we brought them in. You know what I mean? Like, no. You know, their name shall no longer be spoken. I think it's a terrible tactic, and I think it failed, and we were trying to be orthodoxy. And it was like, I'm like, there's no rule that says a non-Jew can't have an honor. There's no rule that you can't celebrate a baby naming of a non-Jew. You know what I mean? Like, so that tactics is a different discussion. But that's really what the conversation today is about, is who has a better strategy. It's not really about Jewish law, because we don't change that very, very much at all. So I wanted to point out the perceptual funnel. Any reactions or questions? And we can move on to the next step. But, because I know where I want to go after that. Okay, I want to go to what's up there. So, right, if you can't see, you probably heard me say it before, so you don't need to know. But, it's a rehearsing. It totally helps me understand the service. So that is a description I'm using with 6th and 7th grade for that is the Saturday morning service in order. So can someone who can read the first one? Okay, so the first step on Saturday morning is Nishmat Kol Chai Tevarech Hashemcha Adonai Eloheinu. Everything that is alive is already blessing God. So don't think you're so special, you human being with a big fat ego. Right? Like, open up your funnel. There's already music happening around you. Like, you can hear the bird that's chirping across the valley. You know, if you open up your, you know. As Rabbi Nachman said, if you can really hear, you hear the grass singing, you can hear the grass breathing. And there's actually a tradition on Shabbat, which I don't keep and I probably should. You're not supposed to walk on grass if you don't have to on Shabbat. You're supposed to take the path. Like, if you don't willy-nilly, like, what? But no, but I kind of like, well, it's breathing, so like it's singing, so don't step on it. And then you go to the next one. Everything that is made of energy is making a sound, and that's part of this music. It's about opening up the funnel, right? Shabbat is a time when we remember the unity of the universe and its wonders. In other words, I say, can I live like this, right? Can I be like, I'm not seeing any of you right now. I'm just seeing your chakras, you know? Like, I can't do that, right? We normally have to live with a perceptual funnel, breaking things down into the objects that we're moving around. And we think are the main thing in front of us. We have to narrow it down. This is the main thing I'm dealing with. I'm going to walk into that, you know, I'm going to walk into that room, let's say the sanctuary with the kids, and I'm going to be like, oh, I can see right away that kid is sad and no one's paying attention. That kid's making noise and needs to shut up because no one can concentrate. Like, even opening up my funnel means I need to be like, oh, now I need to know. Boom, boom, boom. There are only three things I can deal with max, maybe two. So, like, even when we open up, like, we got, okay, now I got to deal with it. Shabbat is the time when you're supposed to be able to open up that funnel. I mean, every prayer time. But, like, if you're like, dude, am I supposed to live in the... No, if you think you're living every moment with an open funnel, you're a fake guru with a gigantic ego, and I won't have anything to do with you, right? So, like, it has to be, like, can you find ways and methods? We're a very humble religion. We're very much like, right, if I sent Nareed off, you know, and she's like, Rabbi, I want to really know how to pray. And I'm like, and I was like, okay, I've got this prayer for you, Nareed. I think it's just right for you. Go and pray this, like, 50 times a day, every day. Or sorry, go and pray this 3 times a day, every day. And if Nareed comes back to me in 2 weeks, he'll be like, Rabbi, you blew my mind. The whole world's changed. You know, like, everything's changed for me. A Jewish attitude would be like, really? Like, that's weird. Like, are you sure? Like, I'm not trusting this. Like we're such a mellow religion. I'm like, I think you went too far. I think you're reading into it. Like, we're like, we want to see, like, little incremental changes. You know, we're not the people. So, like, even the listening and opening up your funnel, if you're like, I've opened up my funnel and I'm feeling the Kabbalistic energies, I'm like, I think you need medication. You know, like, I'm just saying. Like, we're this kind of, like, we're very ordinary, like, we have an ordinary mysticism. It's very, you know, if we're the middle way between, it's a little, you know, come on, it's just, it's very ordinary. It's also very flowing with God. But, like, if you go too far, it's a little weird. So, you know what, on Shabbat, a little taste of the funnel. Don't go, don't manipulate, don't shape and create, you know, the chore list goes out the window. You don't have to go anywhere, even if you have an electric car. I don't use the electric car to go anywhere, just to shul and back. But, like, you know, like, just chill. Play music, take walks, open up, let things happen to you rather than you happening to things. And your funnel will open up a little bit. You may get one insight into where your child is changing that you didn't have before. And then people say, the Shabbat doesn't do anything for me. Did you get one insight out of it? Well, yeah. If you expect more, go get medication. You know what I mean? Like that's the whole thing about the service, right? Well, I don't really like services. Did you get one thing out of services? I did. When we're reading, I read a little thing on the side of the page on 96. It was really, it made me think. I'm like, A+. That's a full success. If that's not enough for you, you're in the wrong religion. Like, go get baptized again and or go hear, who's the guy, the preacher who tells you everything's going to be great and you're going to make a lot of money? Joel Osteen. Right, like, you know, it's like, oh, when I listen to Joel Osteen, I get 60 minutes of feeling great. I'm like, okay, then go listen to Joel Osteen. You're not going to get 60 minutes of feeling great by coming to services here. If you get one thing out of it, right? I kept the whole Shabbat. We couldn't go shopping. I couldn't go, we got hungry. We had to eat out of the pantry because we couldn't try. Like, did you get one thing out of it? Yeah, you know, I at one point my kid got bored and she sang a song and I listened. I'm like, God just gave you a blessing. And you're like, that's all you got out of it, right? You didn't realize that, I realized today, because Lynn pointed out to me, that every time Rob brushes her teeth, she sings. Every single time. I never noticed that before. I mean, I've been noticing it, but I didn't notice. Do you know what I mean? Like, once she said it, I'm like, yeah, Genius has fuck all the time. You know, it's like, I'm like, yeah, that's been going on every day. I've been, like, waiting for her to get out of the damn bathroom so I can get you to school on time. And I'm like, yeah, she's been singing that whole time, never registered, you know. It's like, it's a good day, right? It's all downhill for me. You know, like, so it's like on Shabbat, you open up, one thing happens, you've opened up your funnel, Shabbat's a day where I'm going to let all of, you know, like, I'm going to have the experience. And then you go, everything invisible to human investigation is blessing God all the time. I've got all this, how about all the stuff that's not even coming into my funnel? Because I don't smell like the dog smells. And I don't see theoretical physics, right? I can't see what the telescope in Palomar can see and can teach us about the nature of dark matter, right? Like, so how about all this stuff? How about other universes, right? How about other dimensions? So then you're like, whoa, there's all the stuff that's real. It's not even coming into the funnel, right? And then you're like, whoa. And then you say the Shema. Oh, and then you say the God of everything loves us back, Ahava Rabba, Ahav Tano. So then you're like, that's love. Feel the love. The love is flowing through. Like, you're connected to the whole thing. Like, you're just as... So you're a little itty-bitty piece, and that's supposed to make you feel more loved. You're going to feel... The bigger space you occupy in the universe, the less love you're going to feel. That's the message of Ahava Rabba. And then you say the Shema. You're like, Shema, man. It's all one God. It's God of all of us. Eloheinu. It's all one. And I'm a part of it. And you're a part of it. And we're all a part of it. And then it goes on. And then, you know, the next is when we don't remember the oneness and interconnectedness, we damage our environment. Right? You get the environmental one. The rain ain't going to come. And the cows aren't going to be able to eat their grass. Not their corn. Their grass. If when you are out of touch with the system, it's going to be out of touch with you. Right? And then you get to the Torah service, which is a little different, which is how can I get an insight into wisdom that's going to help me live in this thing, rather than in the tiny little boxy thing of a couple of triangles that at the end of my perceptual funnel that I think is the real universe. Right? How can I open up to change? How can I read today, hear something new, get sensitive to the and receptive to where I need to be this week? Like, what's really going on, where my life is really at, how I can bring a little wisdom of the laws and applying them, and then I'll do this whole thing again next week. So, like, I mean, so then, you know, to me, it's about the perceptual funnel. It's about receptivity and about the relationship of law and living the law with feeling that that's God. That's like God coming in the way that you live with the laws, the way you deal with the Torah of parenting and the Torah of business and the Torah of friendship and the Torah of being a child of another parent. And all those have rules, but how do you, like, are in the flow enough to feel like which rules apply and where you're at and where they're at anew. And so you see the creation that is ongoing, that's happening at every moment. And so that's I'll end with that, which is the concept of Olam Haba. Olam Haba is usually translated as the afterlife. It's the world to come after you die. And for the Kabbalists, they say, forget about that. Olam Haba is the world that's coming every second, because Olam Haba doesn't necessarily mean the world that will come. It means the world that is coming. And so that you are then in touch with the world that is happening, this flow that's happening every minute, that it does happen according to laws. I mean, it's flowing according to principles, and just like scientific laws, the whole universe is operating to them, but there are many intersecting at the same time. And then you're sensitive to it. And that's where we're at. So you're sensitive to the world that's happening and becoming at each moment, and you too. And let's see if I can. And to make everyone happy, can I go? Can I pretend we're going one more line? And for next time, which is, so God says, becoming has sent me to you, and God said further, Moses, thus shall you speak to the Israelites, Yud Hey Vav Hey, becoming is the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and this shall be my name forever, and this shall be my appellation for all eternity, which is, Olam is the word for an eternity of space and time. It's kind of a fancy word for the way infinity becomes finite. And so it's kind of a pun. It's not just like, this is my name for... I mean, you realize how little you get. This is my name forever. No, this is like my name, which is the nexus of infinity becoming time and space, which is what Olam means. And then L'dor V'dor, which is, this will go from generation to generation. And then go assemble the elders, say, I've taken note of what's done to you, and I feel the misery, and I'm going to take you out to a place flowing with milk and honey. And go to them and to the king of Egypt, and you're going to say, it's this becoming thing, the God of the Hebrews manifests himself to us. Now we're going to go, and we're going to leave Egypt to go worship. And yet I know the king of Egypt will let you go only because of a greater might. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with various wonders, which I will work upon them. After that, he shall let you go, and I will dispose the Egyptians favorably toward this people, so that when you go, you will not go away empty-handed, and they'll give you some stuff. And I think that part, you can either read that as God is an entity in the sky, and God is going to send forth plagues to beat up on Pharaoh, because only Pharaoh understands power. Or another way to understand that is that, you know, Pharaoh thinks that this is going to go on forever. That Pharaoh is in charge. It's divinely ordained. This is the way things work. And in a way, when the system is not operating according to the right kinds of rules, and the rules of justice and are part of them, revolution will happen. Just like the one about, you know, there won't be rain. That's part of it. You don't keep up, you know, you're not in harmony with the system, won't be in harmony with you. It's also true of injustice. I feel like people think that there can never be a revolution in America. Like, this is the system. We have the best system. It all works. It's worked for 200 years, right? Right. Right. If you're in Europe or you're in Judaism, 200 years is like, I've got freckles older than 200 years. You know, like, give me a break, 200 years. I totally don't think that. I think the richer keep getting richer in this country and the poorer get poorer. I think that, you know, you just be careful. History has taught us.
It's happening all around the world.
And it, tell me about Stan. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In that part of the world, you know, but it really is. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know what you make of it, but I open up the papers and they say things like, you know, it's not clear that Mexico isn't a failed state, let alone all of the Middle Eastern countries, which are failed states. I mean, you're going to have countries like Saudi Arabia importing oil or weird things. I mean, there's weird stuff happening, you know, and part of it is that, like, Pharaoh things, like, the signs and wonders may just be, whether they're red blood or other kinds of things, the other things, we'll talk about those because that's where a Torah study will go. But, like, you know, when you think that you can force a structure onto the flow and you're not in league with where the flow is, it will come out and surprise you. I think even Trump's election, in the sense that, I'm not going to get political one way or the other, but I want to say it was unexpected, right?
It's safe to say.
It's safe to say, but, like, one thing is, like, that means people didn't have their finger on the pulse. You know what I'm saying? And then people are like, oh, the pollsters underestimated. Forget that. A lot of people got this one wrong. So clearly there is something going on that people weren't, you know, and, like, when you don't have your... And there was something going on that Pharaoh didn't get. I even wonder if it's at the end, this weird thing, why end it here with, even when you go, the Egyptians are going to be, like, disposed favorably toward you?
After stealing
the whole thing is weird, right? And we'll talk about it next time. But there's a part of me that, like, I don't know what happened in American slavery, and I don't know when the slaves were liberated. I would like to think, and I'm probably wrong, but I don't know, that some of the slave owners were like, I'm happy for you. Like, deep down we knew something was amiss. Like, that, as I said before, I think deep down there must have been white Southerners who were disgusted by the system, you know? And I'd like to think that some were like, you know, like, I mean, yes, my world is destroyed, my friends have been killed, half of my family's gone, and Sherman burned my plantation. And it's all because of you guys, but that some of them would be like, go in peace. You know what I mean? And I hope, yeah, something about the flow, that some of them were in touch with it.